Usually when we talk about getting a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like real structural precision.
Right, yeah, like engineering almost.
Exactly. It's like engineering. You break your arm, you get an X-ray, and there's that jagged white line right on the screen, and the doctor just points at it and says, there it is, broken.
And honestly, that is incredibly comforting for both the patient and the physician.
Oh,
I
totally.
mean, we like things to be visible. We like to categorize things into these nice binary columns of, broken or not broken, sick or healthy.
But then you step into the world of metabolic health, right? And
Yes.
obesity management, and suddenly that X-ray machine is essentially useless.
Completely useless. Yeah.
We're looking at this diagnostic and treatment landscape that is just wildly complex. I mean, it's no longer about finding a broken bone.
No, not at
It's
all.
about navigating this deeply interconnected web of like hormones and genetics and environment.
Which is exactly why we are currently witnessing such a massive paradigm shift in this field. We are finally moving away from that archaic, one-size-fits-all approach to weight loss. The future is highly nuanced. It's about highly individualized decision-making between a patient and their doctor.
And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive today. We are taking you, the listener, straight into the clinical
It
trenches.
really are.
Yeah, we're looking at a stack of sources today. Specifically, some incredibly detailed clinical presentations and research papers from the latest Obesity Summit.
Focusing heavily on precision medicine.
Right. And we are going to equip you with the exact insights and clinical trial data that doctors are using right now, like today, to
Exactly.
help patients navigate weight loss plateaus. And spoiler alert here, modern obesity management is no longer about just chasing a lower number on the bathroom scale.
No, we have to completely discard those old vanity metrics.
Yeah.
The clinical conversation isn't how much weight can you lose anymore. It's rather what specific biological threshold do we need to cross to reverse a specific disease process?
Right. It's about the pursuit of actual measurable health gains.
Yeah.
And to really grasp the science here, I think we need to anchor this in a human story from our sources.
I think that's a great idea.
So let's introduce you all to Monica. She is a 62-year-old sales manager. She's looking at retirement in the next few years, and she really wants to travel. But her health is throwing up some major roadblocks.
And she represents a very common, very real clinical scenario that we see every day.
Yeah.
It's this compounding metabolic picture,
Yeah.
where several different systems are under stress all at once.
So let's look at her chart. She lives with obesity. Her BMI is 33.7. Waist circumference is 92 centimeters. And she was diagnosed with prediabetes a couple of years ago.
Right.
So she takes 500 milligrams of metformin. Her HbA1c is sitting at 6.1%. And just so we're all on the same page here, HbA1c is basically a 3-month memory test for your blood sugar.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
And 6.1% puts her squarely in that danger zone just before full-blown type 2 diabetes.
The HbA1c is a critical marker for us. I mean, it tells us her pancreas is working
She's
overtime.
struggling to keep up.
Exactly. It's struggling to clear glucose from her bloodstream because her cells have become resistant to insulin.
And on top of that, she has metabolic syndrome, meaning she's dealing with hypertension and dyslipidemia,
Right.
which really just means her blood lipids, like her cholesterol and triglycerides, are out of whack. And the kicker, the thing really threatening her travel plans, is painful knee osteoarthritis.
A very common complaint.
So 12 months ago, Monica and her doctor took action. She started on semaglutide, scaling up to the 2.4 milligram weekly dose. And she's had success.
She has.
She's lost 10.2 kilograms, which is about 10% of her body weight.
That's a great result.
It is. But she has hit a wall, an absolute weight loss plateau. She still has prediabetes, her knees still hurt, and the scale just will not budge. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Is it biologically surprising that she just stopped losing weight despite being on a highly effective modern medication?
Honestly, it is completely expected.
Really?
Yeah. When you look at the clinical trial data for semaglutide 2.4 milligrams over, say, a 2-year duration, there is a distinct, almost universal pattern.
Okay, what is it?
The vast majority of the weight loss occurs in the first 6 to 9 months.
Oh.
As patients get beyond that 1-year mark, the body's homeostatic mechanisms just kick in. The body essentially defends its new set point and they hit a plateau.
So just biologically speaking, the brain senses the energy deficit and says, all right, we're done losing mass, time to stabilize.
That is the evolutionary survival mechanism at work.
Makes sense.
But here is a crucial distinction that often gets lost in the popular discourse. The plateau is flat.
Meaning what exactly?
Well, with older traditional diet and exercise interventions, a plateau was usually followed by a steady creep right back up to the baseline weight.
Oh, right. The yo-yo effect.
Exactly. The biology would fight back and win. But with these modern GLP-1 medications, if you maintain that 2.4 milligram dose, there is no uptick. Huh. You maintain the body weight reduction out to 104 weeks and well beyond.
I mean, that's a huge victory in itself, right? Just holding the line.
It really is.
But obviously, Monica wants to know why she only lost 10% when she goes online and hears about people losing way, way more.
And this raises a really important question about how we interpret medical data.
Okay.
We often hear the mean or average weight loss in a news headline about a trial, but nobody is exactly average.
Right.
To explain this biological variability to patients, researchers use something called a waterfall plot.
Oh, I saw this in the source material, and it is such a great visual.
It is fantastic.
So for you listening, picture a graph where every single patient in a 72-week trial has their own tiny vertical bar representing their personal weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
And they are lined up from the person who lost the most on the far left to the person who lost the least on the far right. And the top of those bars creates a line that literally cascades down like a waterfall.
And what that waterfall plot reveals is extreme biological diversity. About 92% of people are considered responders, meaning they lose 5% or more of their body weight. Half of the people will lose 15% or more.
Okay.
But only 1 in 3 will achieve a 20% reduction or greater.
And on the extreme edges of that waterfall, you have people who lost an astonishing 45% of their body weight, right?
Yes.
And then on the other end, a tiny fraction of people who actually gained a little weight.
The underlying biology here is just fascinating. I mean, the people who didn't lose weight didn't fail because they lacked willpower or didn't try hard enough.
Right. It's not a moral failing.
Not at all. They're simply biological non-responders to this specific molecule. Conversely, the people who lost 45% are biological super responders.
But what actually makes someone a super responder? I mean, is it just the roll of the genetic dice?
It goes much deeper than just broad genetics. It likely comes down to highly specific neurobiology.
Like what?
Things like the density of GLP-1 receptors in their brain's appetite center, the hypothalamus.
Oh, wow.
Or how their specific vagus nerve communicates fullness from the gut to the brain. Some people's receptors just have a higher binding affinity for the drug, meaning it just works vastly better in their unique system.
That is wild.
And at this point in time, we don't have the diagnostic tools at baseline to measure those receptors and predict who will fall where on that waterfall.
So it's just trial and error.
Basically. The only reliable predictor we currently have is early response. If a patient hasn't responded well in the first 3 to 6 months, they are highly unlikely to suddenly become a super responder a year later.
Okay, so going back to Monica.
Yeah.
She lost 10%. She's a responder, just not a super responder.
Correct.
She's biologically stable. The weight isn't coming back. A lot of people might look at that and say, great job. Take the win. Enjoy the 10%.
Many would.
So why do we even need to push past this plateau?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, modern obesity management isn't about achieving a normal BMI just to fit into a statistical category.
Yeah.
It's entirely anchored to disease thresholds. We now have concrete data showing that specific amounts of weight loss correlate directly with reversing specific disease processes.
Okay, let's walk through those thresholds because I think this is crucial.
For example, if you have prediabetes, losing just 5 to 7% of your body weight is usually enough to prevent that from progressing into full-blown type 2 diabetes.
Which Monica has achieved. She hit 10%, she checked that box, and defended her pancreas.
She did. But what if she wants actual diabetes remission?
Right.
What if she wants her blood sugar to return completely to normal without needing the metformin?
Yeah, that's the dream.
The data from trials like the DIRECT trial in the UK shows that to achieve remission, you need a much larger biological shift, more like a 10 to 15% body weight reduction.
Okay. And some of the conditions mentioned in the sources require even more weight loss. They bring up this thing, metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease with fibrosis.
Yes.
Which is a massive string of clinical jargon.
It is a mouth.
But as I understand it, it basically means a dangerously fatty liver that has started to scar. Right.
Exactly.
And the sources say you need 15% or more weight loss to actually reverse that scarring.
And that threshold is critical because liver fibrosis is the direct precursor to cirrhosis.
Man. So to make sense of why different diseases require different amounts of weight loss, I read this analogy once. Think of your liver like a kitchen sponge that has been completely soaked in heavy bacon grease.
Oh, that's a visceral image.
Right. If you lose 5% of your body weight, it's like wiping down the outside of the sponge. It looks a little better, it functions a bit better, and you might prevent the grease from dripping onto the counter.
Which is like preventing the progression to diabetes.
Exactly. But the inside of the sponge is still clogged. To actually reverse the deep tissue scarring, you have to squeeze the sponge and completely wring it out.
Right.
And that requires the intense systemic metabolic shift of losing 15% or more of your body weight.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. I mean, the biology demands a steeper toll for the heavier, more deeply entrenched diseases.
It's almost like leveling up in a video game, you know?
Yeah.
You lose 5%, you unlock the prevent diabetes achievement. You lose 15%, you unlock the joint relief achievement.
I actually really like that analogy. And let's bring it right back to Monica's main complaint, her knees. She wants to travel.
Right.
There's a very clear, proven dose-response relationship between weight loss and knee osteoarthritis.
Dose-response meaning the more weight you lose, the less it hurts.
Yes, exactly. But the mechanism isn't just about carrying less physical weight.
Oh, really?
The source data charts pain scores and functional scores, and it is a straight downward sloping line. The greater the percentage of body weight lost, the lower the pain scores.
Okay.
Part of that is mechanical, sureless gravity compressing the joint, but a massive part of it is chemical.
Chemical how?
Well, fat tissue, particularly visceral fat, is hormonally active. It actively pumps out inflammatory cytokines that constantly bathe the joints in inflammation.
Oh, wow. So by crossing that higher weight loss threshold, you aren't just taking the heavy backpack off.
Right.
You are actively turning off the chemical fire inside the knee joint itself.
That is exactly the case. So Monica and her GP have a highly valid, evidence-based reason to pursue further weight loss. It is not vanity.
No.
It is mobility and systemic inflammation reduction.
Okay, so Monica's biology is telling her, we're done at 2.4 milligrams. But her knees and her blood sugar are demanding more.
Mm-hmm.
How do you force the body to cross that 15% threshold? I mean, do you have to abandon semaglutide entirely and start from scratch? What is option number one on the doctor's table?
The first logical option is switching medication classes entirely, specifically switching from semaglutide to tirzepatide.
Ah, the newer kid on the block. And this makes sense biologically because tirzepatide is a dual agonist, right?
Yes, it is.
It targets two different hormone receptors, GIP and GLP-1. So it's attacking the metabolic dysfunction from two different hormonal angles, whereas semaglutide is just targeting GLP-1.
Yep.
Exactly. That dual mechanism provides a distinct advantage. We actually have head-to-head clinical trial data comparing the maximum tolerated dose of semaglutide, which in this study was 1.7 or 2.4 milligrams,
right,
against the maximum tolerated dose of tirzepatide, which is 10 or 15 milligrams.
And what happens when you pit the single agonist against the dual agonist in the broader trial population?
The difference in efficacy is pretty stark. Semaglutide resulted in a 13.7% mean weight loss.
Okay.
Tirzepatide achieved 20.2%.
Wow, that is a massive jump.
It is statistically and clinically highly meaningful. Furthermore, if you look at categorical weight loss, crossing those deep disease reversal thresholds we talked about.
Yeah.
One in three patients on tirzepatide achieved greater than 25% weight loss. That is double the rate seen with semaglutide.
Double. Okay. On paper, that sounds like a slam dunk.
It does.
Switch the drug to the dual agonist.
Okay.
Get double the chance of losing 25% of your body weight and saving your knees. But wait, I'm thinking about this from Monica's perspective. Think about the lived reality of these drugs. Dose escalation is often rocky.
Very rocky.
The gastrointestinal side effects, the nausea, the delayed stomach emptying, they can be brutal.
Absolutely.
So if Monica fought through all that a year ago, and now she's finally reached a state where her body tolerates the semaglutide perfectly well, does she really want to throw that biological stability out the window and start over at square one with a brand new drug class?
It's a very common, very valid hesitation in the clinic. I mean, many patients who are stable and tolerating their current medication have zero desire to rock the boat.
I wouldn't.
Even for the promise of more weight loss, the fear of returning to that initial nausea phase is a powerful deterrent.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because the clinical world anticipated exactly this problem.
They did.
If the patient refuses to switch drugs, what is option number two?
Option number two is staying on the exact same drug, but radically changing the rules of the game. It comes from a highly anticipated clinical trial known as the STEP-UP trial.
Yes. The researchers took patients who had already escalated to the standard 2.4 milligram dose of semaglutide, just like Monica.
Exactly like her.
But instead of letting them coast on a plateau, they made a massive leap. They tripled the dose straight to 7.2 milligrams weekly.
No further gradual dose increments, just a sheer step up.
Well, wait, I have a major biology question here.
Okay, shoot.
If 2.4 milligrams of semaglutide already saturates the body's GLP-1 receptors, think of the receptors like parking spots, right?
Sure.
If 2.4 milligrams fills the entire parking lot, where does the 7.2 milligrams park?
That's a great way to think about it.
How does tripling the dose actually do anything if all the receptors are occupied?
It is a brilliant question. The answer lies in pharmacokinetics and the blood-brain barrier.
Okay, walk me through it.
At 2.4 milligrams, you might be completely saturating the receptors in the gut and the peripheral nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
But getting a large peptide molecule like semaglutide across the blood-brain barrier is very difficult.
Oh, I see.
By pushing a massive 7.2 milligram dose into the bloodstream, you create a much steeper concentration gradient.
Yeah.
This forces more of the active molecule across that barrier, allowing it to penetrate much deeper into the brain and hit GLP-1 receptors in entirely different nuclei within the hypothalamus.
Oh, wow.
Areas controlling reward, craving, and deep metabolic regulation that just weren't being fully activated at the lower dose.
That is incredible. So you're basically overpowering the barrier to unlock a deeper level of brain communication.
Exactly.
Now, before we get to the results, I want to clarify something from the trial setup for you all listening.
Yeah.
All the patients were also counseled to maintain a 500 kilocalorie per day deficit and to do 150 minutes of physical activity per week.
Right, the standard lifestyle intervention.
But the placebo group, the people who only did the diet and exercise and didn't get the active drug step up, they only achieved a 2.4% body weight reduction.
Which underscores a fundamental truth we see repeatedly. It is incredibly difficult for a patient with established metabolic syndrome to lose significant weight through sheer lifestyle changes alone. The biology actively fights the calorie deficit.
So diet and exercise get you 2.4%. What did the 7.2 milligram step up get you?
A staggering 20.7% body weight reduction.
Oh my God. You essentially matched the power of tirzepatide without having to switch to a dual agonist drug.
That's the key takeaway here. While we don't have a direct head-to-head trial of 7.2 milligram semaglutide versus 15 milligram tirzepatide, yet numerically the mean weight loss is remarkably similar.
That's huge.
And just like tirzepatide, 1 in 3 patients on the 7.2 milligram dose achieved greater than 25% weight loss.
Double the chance of those massive disease-modifying health gains.
Exactly.
Okay, but I have to play devil's advocate on behalf of the patient for a second.
Yes, do.
Tripling a medication dose sounds inherently terrifying.
Yeah.
If I take triple the dose of anything, I assume I'm getting triple the side effects.
It's a natural assumption.
What happens to the patient's stomach when you blast it with 7.2 milligrams?
The data tells a very, very surprising story regarding tolerability. When you look at the patients who had to permanently discontinue the medication due to severe gastrointestinal adverse events, it was only 2% on the standard 2.4 milligram dose.
Okay, so 2% couldn't handle the normal dose.
Right. And on the massive 7.2 milligram dose, the discontinuation rate for GI events was only 3.3%.
Wait, it barely went up. How is that biologically possible?
Because the receptors in the gastrointestinal tract and the area of the brainstem that controls nausea are already acclimatized.
Well, because they've been on it for a year.
Exactly. The patient has been on 2.4 milligrams for a year. Their body has built a tolerance to the GI effects. So when you step up, the localized gut reaction is minimal, even though you are driving more drug into the deeper brain regions for weight loss.
That is wild.
It's fascinating.
But I did see the sources mention the emergence of a very specific, slightly unusual adverse event linked directly to that 7.2 milligram leap, tysesthesia.
Yes, dysesthesia. It is an alteration in skin sensation. Patients describe it as an unusual, sometimes uncomfortable sensitivity or tingling in their skin.
Like when your foot falls asleep and is just waking up.
Or
like a mild sunburn feeling.
Very similar, yes.
But wait, why would a drug designed to slow stomach emptying and curb appetite make your skin tingle?
Because GLP-1 is not just a gut hormone, it is a widespread neurotransmitter.
Okay.
There are GLP-1 receptors located throughout the central nervous system, including sensory pathways in the spinal cord.
Oh, wow.
When you push that massive 7.2 milligram dose into the system, it spills over and activates sensory nerves that normally wouldn't be stimulated by the lower dose, resulting in that tingling skin sensation.
That is so strange.
In the STEP-UP trial, it affected about 1 in 5 people who made the jump.
1 in 5 is a lot. I mean, if my skin started randomly hurting or tingling after a shot, I'd probably panic.
Which is exactly why communication is vital. The data shows that this dysesthesia is almost always mild. And because the sensory nerves eventually acclimatize, just like the gut did, it generally resolves with time.
Right.
If a GP explains the neuroscience to Monica beforehand, you know, hey, you might feel some weird skin sensitivity because the drug is waking up some sensory nerves, it's safe and it will pass, she is far more likely to remain adherent.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so the stomach handles it, the nervous system adjusts. But I have one more massive pushback, and this is something you see all over the media.
I think I know where you're going with this.
The narrative is that these drugs cause severe sarcopenia, meaning rapid, dangerous muscle wasting. The fear is that you're losing weight, sure, but you're just melting away your muscle mass and becoming frail.
Yes.
Does tripling the dose to 7.2 milligrams just accelerate drug-induced sarcopenia?
It's a critical concern, but the popular press often really misinterprets the physiology of weight loss. To find the truth, the STEP-UP trial didn't just rely on standard bathroom scales or even standard DEXA scans.
What did they use?
They used MRI to measure body composition.
Why does MRI matter over DEXA?
Well, DEXA is good at broadly differentiating fat mass from fat-free mass, but it struggles to accurately visualize and differentiate individual muscle tissue from water weight or organ weight.
Oh, interesting.
MRI is far more precise at mapping out exactly what kind of tissue is disappearing in three dimensions.
Okay, and what did the MRI show?
Of the total weight lost on the 7.2 milligram dose, 85% was fat.
Wow.
And not just any fat. The reductions were greatest in visceral fat volume.
Going back to what we said earlier, visceral fat is that dangerous, hormonally active fat packed around your organs, the fat pumping out those inflammatory cytokines.
Exactly. That is the fat driving Monica's metabolic syndrome. You desperately want to lose it. Now, the remaining 15% of the weight loss was indeed lean tissue.
So you do lose muscle.
You lose some lean tissue, which includes muscle, but here's the biological reality. Losing some lean mass is mathematically inevitable with any significant weight loss. Yes, it takes muscle to carry around 100 extra pounds of fat. When you lose the fat, your body naturally downsizes the muscle it no longer needs for daily movement.
Okay, that makes sense when you put it like that.
However, because you are losing such a massive amount of visceral fat, your overall body composition actually improves.
But, you know, percentages are abstract. What about real life? If Monica loses 15% of that weight as lean tissue, is she going to be too weak to carry her luggage when she travels?
It's all about form versus function. The researchers tested this using a very practical functional assessment called the sit-to-stand test.
Okay.
It is exactly what it sounds like. Timing, how well someone can repeatedly stand up from a chair. It is a gold standard indicator of lower body strength and clinical frailty.
And how'd they do?
The results completely dispel the fear of drug-induced frailty. Physical function in the sit-to-stand test improved across the board for the 7.2 milligram group.
So even though they lost a tiny bit of muscle mass on the MRI, their bodies were so unburdened by the massive loss of fat.
Right.
And their joints were freed from that cytokine inflammation, that they were functionally stronger and faster.
Exactly. The metabolic engine improves dramatically. Remember Monica's prediabetes?
Yeah.
For the patients in the trial who had prediabetes at baseline, 83% of them reverted to...
Or, if she wants to stick with the drug she knows and avoid starting the gastrointestinal adaptation process all over again, she can leverage that massive step up to 7.2 milligrams of semaglutide.
Exactly.
Both offer a path to that 20% weight loss threshold without tripling the side effects and without turning her into a frail shadow of herself.
The clinical tools and our understanding of pharmacokinetics are finally catching up to the biological need.
Which leaves me with one final thought for you to mull over today. We started this deep dive talking about how murky metabolic medicine is compared to a clean, simple bone x-ray.
We did.
And we learned today that biological variability is the ultimate wild card, right? Some people are super responders due to receptor density, some are non-responders, and right now the only way to know is to inject the drug and wait 6 months to see how your brain and gut react.
That's the current reality.
But as precision medicine advances, it makes you wonder what the next decade looks like. What if the future isn't about pushing higher and higher doses to overpower the blood-brain barrier and break a plateau?
That's an interesting thought.
What if instead you take a simple genetic and metabolic swab before your very first injection, and your doctor instantly knows exactly which hormone, which drug class, and which dose your specific biology requires to be a super responder from day one.
I mean, it would fundamentally alter the landscape of preventative medicine.
Getting us a little closer to the precision of that X-ray.
Exactly.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We'll catch you in the next one.